From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Banshee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area. But before I introduce our guest and topic for today, allow me to introduce my co-host, Joelle Mitchell. How are you today, Joelle?
I went to the beach on the weekend, Jason, and while I was there, it was very pleasant. And I was thinking to myself, why won't I do this more often? You know, a little bit of effort to get there, but, you know, once you're there, it's nice. And then the next day I realised and remembered why I don't do it more often, and it's because I'm among the more pasty of the Australian population, and despite having applied sunscreen, I've still got sunburn in just tricky, sneaky little places like the backs of my hand and around my ankles and where my thongs have rubbed the sunscreen off the top of my feet. So
yeah,
there you go.
So in Perth, where we've got very good access to some of the best beaches in the world, and yet Joelle can still turn it into a negative. So there you go.
Thanks, Jason.
So, look, if you are planning on travelling to Western Australia, yes, the sun is quite hot. There is a hole in the ozone layer, apparently. Please put on your sunscreen.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, look, I'd like to introduce our guest for today. She's highly regarded for her ability to blend the academic with the practical. She's currently working as Professor of Work and Mental Health at the Menzies Institute for Medical Research at the University of Tasmania. She's also the founder and director of Pracademia. Welcome to the podcast, Angela Martin.
Thanks a lot, Jason and Joelle. Great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you on. I mean, someone who's been working in the field for as long as you have, it's really great to have someone with your level of experience on the show.
Thank you.
All right, Angela, before we start talking business, tell us about your favourite podcasts. What do you like to listen to?
Well, that's a bit embarrassing because really I don't listen to podcasts, but I've always been meaning to. And then when I saw the one that you guys were doing and putting clips on LinkedIn, I got very interested. So to be completely honest, yours is the first one that I've ever listened to.
Well, what an honour for us, Angela.
Yeah, it's the best one you'll ever listen to.
Absolutely.
As well, Angela.
Yeah,
it's not worthwhile listening to any others.
Don't bother. You've ruined for all future podcasts. So what do you do? Do you read or?
My favourite activity is kayaking. And when we get time, we get out on the water. Tasmania obviously is an amazing place to live and to do things like that with so much coastline. I enjoy getting out into nature, and I think that's a big plus of living in Tasmania.
Yeah, I've certainly heard that. I haven't had the pleasure of visiting Tasmania yet, but definitely lots of people I know go there for sort of regular hiking holidays and that sort of thing. Yeah,
just did a 3-day walk on Bruny Island, which was amazing.
Nice. All right, well, tell us all about your professional career.
So go back on a bit of reflection back over time was interesting for me to think about summarising my career. So when I first finished my undergraduate degree, I worked in the public sector. I got onto a graduate program, and that was in the Queensland public sector. I worked as a research and policy officer in various portfolios for a few years, and then went back to do my PhD at Griffith University. So got my PhD at the end of 2002, which makes me seem very old, and then just had a bit of a standard academic career, really, for the first 10 or 15 years, teaching mainly in business schools into MBA programs. Really enjoy working with managers with some experience and getting them to reflect on how they manage and how that impacts people. So yeah, a long time in the University of Tasmania's MBA program, and also obviously conducting research mainly in what you could probably describe in the business discipline as organisational behaviour. Came from that psychology background, and pretty much most of my time was spent working in business. Just a bit of how I sort of came to be very interested in mental health. My PhD was looking at people's psychological adjustment during organisational change. And obviously that's going back some time ago when change programs were a thing that were managed, but now I guess we deal with constant change. But the outcome variables I was looking at were psychological health. And obviously the role of the work environment and, you know, management practices and change management, that was my original interest. And then I guess as society also started to pick up more discussions around mental health, you know, really integrating that and thinking about how does mental health intersect with business and organisations. So that sort of took me on this journey because I was teaching in management of focusing a lot of my early research on the critical role of managers in employee mental health. So a lot of my early work looked at things like stigma of mental health and how managers can be really positive towards helping support mental health or, you know, kind of stigmatizing and negative and discriminatory. So, you know, a full range of experiences. Another just a key sort of moment in my career was that I had a sabbatical in 2012 and I went to Canada. And I know you had Marianne Bainton on talking about the Canadian standards. So that was a really pivotal point for me then as well, learning what Canada was doing and getting very enthused and excited about what could happen in Australia. So that's where kind of I got 100% focused really on the workplace mental health agenda in Australia. And so then the end of 2016, I decided to take a career break from academia. I was getting very frustrated by all this research that we were doing and trying to get people to understand this sort of evidence-based approach and thinking, well, okay, maybe I need to get out of academia for a while and start working in industry. So I set up academia and sort of went full steam ahead with that for a couple of years. I've recently been invited back into a part-time academic appointment, as I said, just research only. And that's because I still really have this love of PhD supervision, helping the next generation of researchers and sharing the knowledge that I've gained in my career to date. And that enables me to still stay active in research, which I think is really important if evidence base is, you know, one of the key points of your business.
Fantastic. That's a very long and fascinating career that you've just described to us, Angela, and plenty more ahead, I'm sure. So thank you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so tell us a bit more about Pracademia then. So what is it? Why did you choose to start it?
Yeah, so it started off, it was just me saying, I want to do more work that has impact. I want to actually see some of that research that I've spent a long time doing and working with other people to do, start to make a difference. Because, you know, I know I've listened to some of what you've said too, the things that we've been doing haven't been working, you know. And wanting to actually work with leaders and organizations to create positive change. So I just went out on my own and through word of mouth referrals and things got very busy very quickly, which was great, doing all sorts of interesting things. So really loving that. And then I brought on a co-director, my business partner, Dr. Sarah Dawkins, who is also registered as a clinical psychologist, because there really is that interface between the clinical and the organisational. And then we just started to expand, I guess, our network of people that we bring in for certain projects, depending on the expertise that's required.
So why did you decide to set up Pracademia and start doing that work?
Just really to get that research translation happening and to sort of find out from the industry side of things too, what the needs and burning issues were and problems were that, again, you could take back to researchers to help to solve. So really helping, I guess we talk about Pracademia as being that bridge between academic, strong, rigorous research and business problems and realities and needs, and just trying to connect the two. Because I think, you know, it's like a boundary spanning type of organisation. And our tagline really is academic insights for practical advantage. So we're finding lots of academics who are also sort of really motivated to have impact. I guess in our research policy in Australia, they're putting more emphasis on that now. You can't just go and write your papers that only 10 other academics will read. you have to show that you're making a difference, you know, with whatever area you're working in.
Yeah, interesting. I'm interested also to know, I guess, when an employer or organisation reaches out to you, are there any commonalities in terms of the problems they're experiencing, or, you know, where you need to start with them?
Yeah, I mean, they come in to contact with us at all different levels of maturity. So for some, it's they've never done anything before in relation to mental health, so they're starting from scratch. And so what they need is a bit of needs analysis, maybe a little bit of initial discovery work with the employees, and then starting to work on a strategy so that whatever they do actually is strategic and not just these sort of add-on things that I know you've critiqued. But some are quite mature already and they want a very specific piece of knowledge. So one example might be I did a project for BHP actually over your way about a new site that they were setting up. You know, they wanted to know, summarise the evidence on psychosocial risk for FIFO workers, for example, and if we're creating a new site, what are some of the things that we can do and look at to, you know, prevent mental health disorders as well as manage those in, you know, workers that are away from their families. So that's an example of a more mature practice, but that wanted a very sort of specialty emphasis and a bit of evidence review done. So, yeah, it's very different all the time. It's very exciting because you're getting to understand all these different occupational contexts that people work in. Police and emergency services is another area that I've done a bit of work in. But, you know, I've even been out to the local paper mill to talk to operators in control rooms for 10 minutes to say, what is mental health? You know, really starting at that very basic literacy level. So there's a lot of variety in what I work on.
Yeah. And I guess the whole idea about Pracademia, as you said, is to translate really good, thorough research into the practical. The other half of that obviously is more the research side, and that's where you're supervising PhD students. So what are some of the interesting areas that they're looking at the moment with the students that you're supervising?
I've had, I think, nearly 20 now PhD graduate, and they've done a whole range of very interesting topics. To summarise, quite a few on leadership and positive modes of leadership that are, you know, health promoting for employees. I've had someone look at the issue of presenteeism due to mental distress, so turning up for work when you're currently experiencing depression or anxiety and having some impacts from that. I've had someone look at humour in the workplace. We've looked at a concept called psychological capital, which is a positive psychology concept that's been adapted to how people respond to challenges at work. I've got Adam Nebs, who people on LinkedIn probably have seen a lot of posts from. He's looking at assessment tools so organisations can sort of see, well, where are we at in terms of our strategy, you know, indicators that we're using an integrated approach, which is one of the areas I've worked on a lot with my colleague Tony LaMontagne from Deakin University. So looking at how do they sort of come and often ask, how are we doing? You know, I know we're doing stuff, but, you know, we want to be best practice. So we're looking at ways of being able to benchmark, and I guess that's maybe similar to some of what you're doing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a good broad range of really important areas to research. If you talk to Tony anytime soon, or if he's listening to this episode, can you please encourage him to get on? We've been getting a couple of people in his ear, we talk about the integrated model regularly, and that's, you know, the basis of our work as well. So, let him know. We'd love to chat.
I will. He's a hard man to catch, but, you know, he really has been a fantastic career mentor in the academic side of things. And that model, you know, we published that in 2014 and it's popping up everywhere. It's been quite influential. It's nice and simple, which works really well for Pracademia as well, because when I talk to managers, I say there's three things you need to focus and that's not too overwhelming. But you need to make sure those three things are in concert and not in silos. And again, I really concur with a lot of your comments on that on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'll try to put in a good word for you to get Tony on, because he really is a major player in this field.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely try to move people away from the mitigate illness and promote thriving and look at that prevention of harm in particular, which seems to be the big missing.
That's thing. Where he came into the field from as well.
Yeah, terrific.
All right. So I don't know if you heard our episode with Jennifer Lowe from the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
Yes.
So she was talking about small business in particular and some of the challenges that small business owners face when they're trying to do things like implement codes of practice and sort of understand objective-based legislation and that sort of thing. And they really just want somebody to tell them what are the things that I need to do. Rather than trying to interpret really broad clauses and then work out how that actually applies to them. So you've been doing some work with small businesses in the psych health and safety space. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it goes back actually to one of my first big projects, which was an Australia Research Council linkage grant. And it was called the Business in Mind Project. So that was from 2009 to 2012. So it's quite a while ago now, but that was my first foray into that area of how does mental health and small business interact. And, you know, I was really motivated to actually do some research, but also offer practical support to those people. So we set up Business in Mind with our partners Beyond Blue and WorkCover Tasmania and created an intervention that could be kind of like a taster of what you might do in a workplace mental health workshop, but very tailored to their situation. So we had business owners from all different kinds of settings talk about their experiences of stress and how they managed it. If they had employees, you know, what were some of the issues coming up for them in managing employee mental health within that small business setting. So that website is still up there, even though it's, you know, a bit old now. And you can see that we structured it around five specific brief kinds of intervention. The first one was a little bit of mental health literacy. Second one was talking about coping with stress, which is probably one of the more preventative sides of things. There was stuff on because working hours is a big risk, long working hours for small business operators, thinking about creating some balance in your life so that you're not working 60 plus hours 6 days a week, which actually is pretty common. And then also issues around relationships because, you know, obviously relationships with employees, with suppliers, and, you know, procurement, you know, processes with larger organisations. A lot of the stress, you know, for small business owners comes into managing those various relationships and also thinking about challenges and how they approach challenges, which is sort of more your secondary level intervention sort of content as well, and just how they can seek help because they don't have employee assistance programs or anything like that. So making sure people understand ways that they can be supported with their mental health. So that was Business in Mind. And then down the track a bit, I was asked to work with the federal government department that looks after small and family businesses. And more recently, they've started doing some initiatives in the area as well. So, yeah, that's where we're at with small business. It's getting on the radar now. The National Workplace Initiative coming out of the Mental Health Commission has put out some resources for small businesses and starting to recognise even not just small businesses but micro or sole operators or sole traders, you know, are actually quite a large proportion of our workforce, but there's really been nothing for them. So I was hoping to talk a bit about that because it's really different. You can't just put everyone in a lump called small business. That's probably one of the biggest things that I've learned is that context is so variable, whether you have staff or not, whether you've only got two staff or, you know, 80, whether you are a contractor rather than what people think of as small businesses, as entrepreneurs and things like that. So that's the first thing, is just it's so diverse. So when Jennifer, you know, was talking about how they might look at codes of practice. That's obviously for businesses that have employees and they have responsibilities under workplace health and safety legislation. But if you sort of think for a minute about all the people who actually work by themselves, they've got to do their own occupational health and safety to themselves. And so, you know, that can be a real challenge, because if it's not a legal requirement, are they going to do anything if they're not, you know, maybe motivated by having a crisis or being in a burnout sort of stage? But for those employers who have, you know, maybe 10 or 20 staff members, quite often they've had no management training before. So the people management stuff can get quite hard and can be tricky. The concepts around psychosocial factors in the workplace are quite esoteric to the average small business person. Even the topics of things like, oh, well, how do you assess job control of your workers? So, you know, in a big organization, you'd have a survey out, you know, evidence-based measures, and look at, you know, what the levels of job control are like in different areas of the business. But when you've only got 10 people, you know, for them, that is seeing overkill. We can't afford to have a consultant in to do a survey. You know, how are we going to look at psychological health and safety in a small business? So what I recommend is that the same principles in the integrated approach apply, but they look different and they have to be tailored to that specific setting. But I guess what you can do for something like, instead of a great big risk assessment survey, you know, you could think about, when you hire a staff member, in that initial induction conversation, say to them, you know, we have a basic policy here about psychological health and safety and about mental health. So we're really set up that we're open to discussions about these issues, whether it's something at work that might be creating a bit of stress for you. I want to know about it as the business owner, and I want to try and find ways of, you know, reducing that impact or eliminating that stressor if it's possible. And, you know, maybe you've got stuff going on at home, maybe work's going great for you, but, you know, there are other issues and you might feel, you know, that you need some support. I'm just opening the door for that conversation that I'll, you know, even though we don't have an employee assistance program, you know, I can help link you up with services and things if you need it. So even just something really basic, like a 10-minute conversation at the start of employing someone, can help you set up that little micro culture of how you operate and how you work with each other. Yeah, so that's like one basic point. It could be, if it's a little bit larger, maybe you have 20 employees, I've heard about things like a suggestion box that's anonymous, that any employee can write down, you know, maybe a problem, and they someone takes them out and has a look at them. And in the staff meeting, they talk about, well, we had 5 on customer aggression this week, so let's start thinking about what we can do about that. You know, it's hard when you don't have the resources to pay for lots of specialist training like big companies do. But there is now starting to be stuff available with, you know, freely available resources and things on the internet. And there's lots of new programs and things coming out to really try and deal with this issue of helping small business.
Thanks, Angela. A lot of that resonates with me, because my dad has always been a small business owner my whole life. So I grew up on a farm, and he's, you know, being a farmer along with running other sort of small businesses, but quite sort of high hazard, you know, timber mill. He was making handmade furniture for a while. So lots of, sort of high hazard type businesses, but in that capacity of having really only a few employees. And I know, sort of grappling with some of those OHS requirements with such a small team is always a challenge. A lot of that really resonated with me. Thank you for that.
It's really hard. I just wanted to say, someone like your dad, I've interviewed, obviously, over the years, so many small business operators, and they say You have to be an octopus. You've got eight arms. You're the HR, you know, you're the OHS, you're the finance, you're the marketing, you're the cleaner. You know, there's just that sort of so much job demands in different areas, and a lot of them you're not trained for. So, you know, it is really hard.
Absolutely. And then I think as well, in those really very small businesses, personality issues really become magnified. You know, where in a larger business, if you've got somebody that you tend to conflict with, you can just avoid them.
Yeah.
But you just can't do that in that small small business environment. So those sort of what might be viewed as petty matters can really be magnified and become significant irritators and hazards for people.
Definitely. And I've described it before as small business mental health, the good, the bad and the ugly, because there are actually some really terrible situations that people find themselves in because they don't have that broader network of support, because there's only a couple of other people there and they don't have an HR person they can go to. They don't have, you know, any training at all offered to them about mental health and coping with stress. So you can get some really horrible situations, I guess, like in the Victorian case where they brought in Brodie's Law about bullying in a cafe, you know, that resulted in a suicide of a young person. And, you know, in a small business, there just aren't those safety nets and checks and balances. And, you know, bad stuff still happens in large organisations too, but people are quite vulnerable. But on the flip side, also, I've seen some of the most fantastic work environments in small businesses where people feel like they're each other's family members almost, and they find ways to manage conflict that inevitably occurs, and they have a good supportive culture. So, like I said, it can vary a lot.
Yeah, you're talking a bit before about when you're, you know, either a sole trader or in a very small business, micro business, that the founder often has to wear multiple hats, and that can be a bit of a stressor, obviously, in itself. I'm interested to know if you've worked with any startups before. I mean, we're operating as a startup ourselves, right? And, you know, I have seen some people who specifically focus on startup founder mental health. Have you done any work with startups?
No, I haven't specifically worked directly with startup founders, but I guess I've been in situations where I've been speaking to audiences that included them and taking questions from them. I have worked a little bit with someone called Leanne Faulkner. I don't know if you have come across her work, but she is an advocate for micro businesses and small traders on the sort of national scene. And so she's someone that I can sort of refer you to that might be able to speak to that. Because yeah, it's not an easy path, is it, to start a business and grow a business into you know, a company, for example. You know, I started as a sole trader and then became incorporated, and then, you know, the next transition for me will be whether I am able to employ people or sort of whether I work in that network of contractors.
Yeah, we're quite fortunate in that, you know, we're growing now quickly because we've had some success, been able to add Joelle to the team, and she's been a very useful addition. Yeah, I see it quite often with startup founders. They're very passionate, obviously, about what they do and wanting to change the world and all the rest. And you can see them, you know, the passion is what keeps them going.
Yes.
But you can see them driving themselves to burnout.
And be really prone to burnout, definitely. And there are different issues, like I said, about the diversity of what comes under that topic of small business. There are those entrepreneurs that have got a social mission or a wealth building mission, which is very different to someone who has been made into a contractor by being made redundant by a large organisation, that is ultimately turned into an insecure de facto employee. And then, of course, we have the gig economy and all of those issues now starting to come on the radar under regulation. So yeah, there's some quite vulnerable people in our workforce within that gig economy sector. And again, we need solutions for the different types of needs of the diversity of small businesses. I think the problem has been they're just being lumped into one category. And the area that I can see that's really important to look after those people is at the policy level. So the interventions may not necessarily be directly at the business level, but some examples of really good policy level initiatives that I've seen. For example, I did a job recently for Safe Work New South Wales, and they paid my invoice within 7 days. They had set that up as an expectation to all their suppliers, which I thought was really amazing, because a lot of the bigger companies that I work with can take 30 or 60 days to pay you. So, if you are small and starting up, cash flow can be one of the main stresses. You've got to find somewhere to pay the employees, and none of your invoices have been paid, so you don't get any pay that week, you know. That's the reality. So the policy level stuff. And the other thing I want to make sure to mention, if there were any listeners maybe more in that government setting or even in big corporates, what they do in their supply chain really matters. How they set up their contracting and procurement and how they deal with small businesses really matters. And that can be one way of promoting the mental health of people, is to look at your procedures and your processes for business-to-business transactions.
Yeah, I was interested actually to see in the draft ISO 45003 standard that they actually did talk about procurement as part of that.
So. Yeah, and usually, again, people don't necessarily think of it. Mm. But one example with the BHP project, going back and not was revealing too much of the work that I did, but, obviously they subcontract, they have big chains, big supply chains. And so one way that they could help is to ensure that anyone that they contract for a job has their own internal policies around mental health. Like, just like now, to get jobs, you have to show that you have work health and safety okay, or gender diversity okay to get the work. You will also have to show that you have something there about occupational psychological health.
Yeah.
So you can affect it that way. It sort of then makes it part of an industry practice.
Hmm. Yeah, I asked that question actually at Wade Needham in episode 2 around, often there's a requirement for larger contracts, I guess, that a company has been certified to ISO 45001 or can show evidence they've adopted it. Yep. So I was interested if there would be a similar approach, but, a good starting point, as you suggest, is just making sure that they have policy and procedure around health and safety and worker wellbeing.
You can start off fairly basic and not too onerous for the business, but signalling the importance of it, I think, as a competitive advantage for the business involved.
Yeah. You mentioned before, for small business owners, there's a range of really good websites out there.
Yes.
Can you name maybe a couple for our listeners?
Yes. Well, obviously people can look at the old Business in Mind stuff anytime. It's freely available. It's video based with a short resource kit that is really designed to be very simple, because, again, a lot of the interventions and things that are out there are, a 12-hour course or things like that. We wanted something that was like 1 hour with a little magazine-style thing to read just about the issues. And we also got on our videos our business people telling their stories rather than us kind of preaching what they should do, just to help with that initial awareness piece. But, it's moved on since then, and I would recommend Ahead for Business. That is a program run by an organisation called Every Mind. And the federal government gave them some funding to broaden out the scope outside of New South Wales to national. So if you are a small business owner listening, go onto the Ahead for Business website. There's some great stuff in their program across the board. And the other new initiative that I'd be really keen for people to know about is Beyond Blue has now got a small business new access program coming online. And that is kind of like a free EAP for 4 sessions for small business people or their staff. So have a look at Beyond Blue's new access. I think that will start up in June. And they will have business coaches who are trained in, you know, mental health support as well as business issues, which I think is really important. So it's not like calling Lifeline and having some counselling. It's in that business context of business coaching. And that's one of the things I found with my Business in Mind project is that business people prefer the business as usual or the integrated into how my business can be successful more so than I'm struggling with mental health, you know, I need, you know, an intervention around depression and anxiety. You know, there's still a bit of stigma around that. And, yeah, I think if as much as you can integrate stuff around mental health into usual business practice, the more business people will use it and feel comfortable with it.
Yeah, tricky.
Yeah, that's certainly the approach that we're trying to take as well with, you know, the mental health and the, you know, the psychosocial hazard identification is part of a normal, your normal business process of hazard identification and risk management. It's not something separate. It's not something scary. It's not a black box that requires, you know, a specialised task force of mental health experts. It can just be part of your business as usual.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I agree with what you were saying there in that, you know, a lot of probably the mental health hazards for small business owners are in relation to the business itself and the practical aspects of actually managing that business. So I think, if Beyond Blue have got some business coaches working in that preventative and helping space, that's going to be a lot more useful than just having counsellors available for those small business owners. So I'm really glad to hear that.
Good. There is movement happening now, I think, and COVID has accelerated that. You know, as I mentioned, there is a guide that's been released by the Mental Health Commission, and it's a sort of maintaining mental health during COVID or mentally healthy workplaces, but they've made three versions of the guide. One is for sole traders, one is for small business, and one is for larger businesses, which I think is really nice because it enables you to not put audiences off with messages, you know, about things that just don't exist in small businesses. So I was really pleased to see that they'd started to nuance their guidelines and advice and things to these sort of three different settings. Yeah, so I recommend those. The other one, there's a great project going on at the moment that I'm assisting with through Deakin University, where they are working with accountants, financial advisors, and bookkeepers. And again, integrating into business as usual, because every business is in touch with their accountant. It's obviously a critical function to business management, and they're training up the accountants in how to support people in distress, how to refer, how to, you know, just approach the issues. Again, thinking about the ecosystem around small businesses and that more macro view rather than direct to the business owner. So that's also another, you know, good initiative that's going on that's actually being researched and evaluated to see if it makes a difference.
I think that's a fantastic idea. Yeah, who are the professionals that small businesses rely on, and let's train them in identifying some of the signals that there might be trouble there, and giving them some basic skills in how to reach out and offer some assistance.
Yeah, so it's just thinking
sort of like a peer support program, but for professional services.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. You know, if people in small business ask me for advice, you know, what can I do to stay mentally healthy, or, you know, if I'm recovering from a mental health disorder, one of the most important things is the social networks. Because a lot of people work on their own, I would recommend joining any sort of business groups, industry associations, you know, even start up your own coffee group with other business people in your sector. Just being able to access that social support that we know is so critical to our mental health, and realizing, you know, that other people are dealing with similar stresses and sharing tips and strategies. You know, it's probably my number one recommendation is if you're working on your own, join a few business groups, even if it's a once a month, you know, 2 hours evening meeting or something, to just get connected and see how, you know, what's going on in your business might compare with others.
Yeah, I like that idea. And it's not about going to these networking groups and talking about all the stresses of your role and, you know, how your mental health is suffering. As we've talked about with previous guests, it's about, well, a lot of the stresses are work-related and can have a mental health outcome. So why not actually deal with the stresses? And so if you're dealing or talking with people who are facing similar problems to what you are, then through that power of groupthink or, you know, getting examples from others' experience, then we can deal with the root cause of the mental health issue rather than just the symptoms.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's really important, even though it might be hard to make that first step, that can work really well.
Yeah, terrific. So, yeah, it sounds like you're doing and have been doing for quite a while, Angela, some fantastic work and really good to see some of these things that are changing and new resources that are being developed. And glad to see that the pandemic has spurred some action in this area as well.
Definitely, because I think, you know, when you've got, you know, all the world experiencing communally some sort of distress, it probably has helped with the stigma part of things and normalizing, you know, being a human and being distressed by things that maybe are out of your control. And, you know, businesses are really vulnerable to those market forces. And as we've seen, even in Australia, where we probably haven't been impacted as much as some other countries, there's still been a lot of businesses collapse or, you know, that are sort of barely hanging in there to be financially viable. And I think, you know, in the next few years, we're hoping for recovery, but, you know, there will be many individual cases of distress that, you know, people that need supports and government interventions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think we are about to see a lot of rapid changes in this area, and that's hopefully one of the benefits to come out of this pandemic. Yeah. So what are some of your hopes for the future of workplace mental health?
I guess my hope is for that awareness to translate, as you said, into rapid change, because we do have now the National Workplace Initiative, you know, currently in formulation, and I was involved in a group of consultants that helped the Mentally Healthy Workplace Alliance get the funding for that National Workplace Initiative. I'm really hoping to see its impact in the next few years. That's very exciting. So there's also been the Productivity Commission's report. For anyone who wants to read about the workplace stuff, it's chapter 7. There's some really interesting recommendations in there. And the code of practice in particular, I think that's going to be a very hot topic over the next 12 months. And, you know, I really hope that generally in the business community, the awareness of the actual legislative requirements to assess and control risk are starting to be better understood. It doesn't help when the language is very, you know, to the average person, the language around psychosocial safety and even some of the work-related factors that Safe Work Australia has guided people to pay attention to, some of them still seem quite esoteric to the average person in a small business. So I think that's the area we've got the most work to do. I think we've done pretty well on getting people to understand, you know, they need to seek help if they're distressed, or those supportive conversations that they can have with employees around the mental health. But it's this prevention piece that my hopes are pinned on making more impact from educating people around, you know, that they do have a requirement, and then how to actually do that to be compliant. And that's what the codes of practice, I guess, are attempting to do, to make it concrete for people. But there will be, it's a change process in itself, isn't it? Getting people out there in organisations and businesses to really understand what actually is kind of complex, which is social determinants of health. You know, people study that for a couple of years at university to, you know, really grasp a lot of what's in that. And we're wanting the general public to start understanding that mental health is not just about that individual person. It's about the settings. It's about the socioeconomic stuff. It's about, you know, the experiences of discrimination or harassment. It's all sorts of factors, and then thinking how it looks in their business. Even just being able to get businesses to say, well, we'll focus on the top two or three factors that we know affect a lot of our employees. So, that's where my hope is that prevention gets really accelerated in the next few years.
Yeah, totally agree with that one.
Yeah, I would say that is also our hope.
Yes.
All right. So, Angela, we expect that a reasonable portion of our listeners are people who are interested in getting involved in this psych health and safety space at work. Do you have any words of advice for them?
In terms of as a career?
Mm.
Oh, absolutely. It's a fantastic career. Like I said, there's so much variety in the type of work you do. There's a lot of meaning in it, which is good for your own mental health to know that you're contributing to the quality of working life experienced, you know, by millions of people in Australia. And, you know, hopefully getting these sort of really fundamental things right in our workplaces will see those benefits for the businesses, but for our society as a whole. So it's a fantastic area to be working in. It's going to be very busy the next few years, for sure. And you just really encourage people to find their niche in that area of trying to prevent mental health disorders, as well as, you know, managing them more effectively if they occur in the workplace.
Yeah, I think finding the niche is the critical part there, because there is so many different facets to this work, and it's not something that just a single skill set is going to be able to deliver. So yeah, find what you're good at,
yeah,
and then find how that fits within the puzzle, I guess.
Yeah, and exactly with Pracademia, what we try to do is network and work together with either other businesses or other people, you know, that have different niches, and work in a multidisciplinary way, because people just have these different perspectives they can bring to the table, and they're all very valuable.
Yeah, terrific. Well, Angela, we wanted to talk about psych hazards and psych health and safety for small businesses, and I don't think we could have had a better guest on to discuss that topic. So thank you so much for not only sharing some really practical wisdom, but some really practical resources as well that small business owners could go to.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyable conversation. Good luck to all your listeners in their work.
Yeah, well, tell us a bit about how our listeners can find out more about your work and Pracademia.
Yeah, so you can look at the website, which is www.pracademia.com.au, and you can see some of the projects that we've done. Or if you're more interested in research, you can go to the University of Tasmania website and just search my name. You'll see my profile and you can click on all of my publications. I'm very happy to talk to people on either the practice or the research front. So please get in touch if you have a question or something you'd like to ask me.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So don't forget, we video these calls that we have with our guests. So if you want to see the video version rather than listen to the podcast, you can check it out on the Flourish DX YouTube channel. For those of you who struggle to get through 45 minutes to an hour of a long form podcast, we also do short clips, as Angela mentioned earlier, on LinkedIn. So some of the golden nuggets we'll be sharing on the Flourish DX LinkedIn page. Joel and I are way too active on LinkedIn, as we keep saying. So if you send us a connection request or a follow, we'll probably respond very quickly to you. We do like, you know, continuing the conversation on LinkedIn with like-minded professionals. But thanks again to everyone, and we'll catch you next episode.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.